Mini episode 665 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by First Down Scouting, delivering the most thorough scouting service available, uncovering the NFL stars of tomorrow. Follow them on the web at the number one, stdownscouting.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello once again, everybody. If you were looking for great Royal Rumble talk, you came to the right place. Rick Morris and Kyle Ross in the FDH Lounge for you, continuing our history of the Royal Rumble anthology. We are up to the year 2002. This is part 4C of our series. If you want to catch a sort of macro overview of the entire Royal Rumble, the concept of it at all, go back to the one that we did for 1A, which was 1988, the first year. We got about a good 10, 15 minutes, I think, setting that one up. But we are up to 2002. You, Kyle, have broken up these eras historically here. So I know that this is from the war to the game, I believe you said this is, right? Am I paraphrasing that correctly?
Exactly.
All right.
And okay. This is the final part of that. We started in 2000,
mm-hmm.
and the three main talking points, I think, for this era,
mm-hmm.
I had focused on, number one, the death of WCW, and mm-hmm. as we come into 2002,
right.
it is now officially dead.
Right.
It is no longer in existence, and not only that, the invasion angle, the biggest screw-up any promotion in the history of the industry has ever made,
yep.
has come and gone. You wouldn't even have known that by watching this show,
that's
by the
right.
way, which we're going to talk about that momentarily.
Right.
And then my second and third points that we talk about from this era is it's the rise of Triple H,
mm-hmm.
and it's also the rise of the Rumble pay-per-view itself to the number two show of the year behind, obviously, WrestleMania.
That's right.
And we'll talk about in a little bit, probably towards the end, why ultimately Triple H failed as a babyface
mm-hmm.
here. But you do have to give the devil his due, so to speak, I think. This show is the most bought Rumble ever.
Yeah.
675,000. It's not by a wide margin. I believe it's, you know, I think 99 actually was close, of all things. And I
right.
think 2001 was pretty close. But, you know, there's always got to be one pay-per-view that's the record holder for the
that's
respective
right.
thing, and I'm looking at it right here. I'm just going to double check here. I should have this open. Yeah, 2002, 670. Pardon me, not 675.
Right.
I inflated it by 5,000.
Okay.
But 99 did 650. 2001 did 625. In the years that followed this one, the
mm-hmm.
brand split era, they generally were between, generally speaking, were between 530 and 580.
Right.
So pretty strong, but you know, this was a good number. It speaks well to Triple H. He got the big comeback pop in the garden after spending most of 2001 on the shelf.
Right.
Which is interesting and something I want to talk about.
Well, they capitalized on that very, very well in terms of him being out. And, again, the whole YouTube video, It's a Beautiful Day, which Edge and Christian later on parodied very well on Kazoos.
Yes.
So they positioned it for him to come in and be a mega face under the circumstances. And that was
which was interesting because it was the first time, I remember, and maybe this is, you know, you're always kind of the resident Nelson nitpicker, but I remember at the time I was like, oh, it's interesting they're doing this because he was a top heel and had been a top heel for so long.
Yep.
It was the first time that they just decided, yeah, we're going to make this guy a face, even though he hadn't done anything storyline-wise
that's right.
to justify that.
Right.
Now, it worked, obviously, here. We're talking about this show doing big business. It's a star-studded show.
Right.
And the business was, in spite of themselves, obviously, it probably should have been a lot more, given what they had to work with in 01 and pissed away. But at this point, watching this show, Triple H as a babyface worked. Now, there
right.
wasn't a lot of shelf life there.
The closest that they had come, I would say, to something like that, in terms of identifying a reason to cheer for him, and this is very subtle here and there, probably went over the heads of the crowd. I think they did make reference to him battling through and finishing the match
yeah.
with Austin.
Yeah.
And he showed guts. Yeah. He went out on his sword,
and
et cetera.
He was if you recall, if you were reading the sheets at the time,
right,
was originally supposed to turn face in that era. He was going to be, because remember, he had beaten Austin before Austin turned heel, and at WrestleMania, and Triple H, that was done, I guess, with the idea that Triple H would be a top babyface contender for the heel Austin. Now, it never worked because he got hurt, and then, you know.
That's right.
They had the WCW angle, and at the risk of beating a dead horse, pissed it away.
Right. Well, we talked about a little bit earlier in part four of the Rumble history, as far as it went with Triple H, the sort of tease that they did in the summer of 2002, I compared it to The Rock in the fall of 98, the pseudo face turn.
You mean the summer of 2000?
Summer of 2000, yeah, I'm sorry. Summer of 2000, similar to The Rock in the fall of 98. And it's weird because on a psychological level, I almost feel like it really works well with wrestling fans because it's kind of like the forbidden fruit of like, damn it, I don't know if I'm supposed to cheer for this guy. He's not a full-blown face
yet. Well, they had wanted to cheer for him for some time.
Right.
And the way he was booked,
strong as a heel.
When it's known very well now.
Right.
When a heel's booked that strong, particularly, I mean, no heel had ever been booked as strong as he was, arguably, the fans inevitably will start cheering for the guy.
That's right.
I mean, I guess that was not without historical precedent. I mean, Roddy Piper, if you want to go all the way back to, like, 86.
Kind of similar.
Yeah, you know,
similar.
He really, to be honest, he got to come, you know, that I was wrong when I said that. Now that I've referenced that name, he got maybe the original comeback pop. Remember, he came back for a jobber match against A.J. Petruzzi or whatever the guy's name was.
Right.
And the crowd went wild for Piper. And then, you know, they obviously handled that face turn much better than Triple H's here.
They did.
But, no, that was kind of the original comeback pop, Piper.
It kind of was.
A strongly booked heel.
That's what will happen with a strongly booked heel eventually here. But it got some notes just briefly on leading up to the show to kind of set the tone here in terms of there had been, after the failed invasion, I'll tell you what, the closest I think we've seen, you talk about panic moves, this was a Russo reset. The night after the invasion, it's like it never happened. You had turns in the course of a couple months, not just Triple H. The night after invasion, simultaneously, Austin and Angle doing a double turn there. You had very closely on their heels Taker to become a big-time heel because there was a gaping vacuum of heels during the invasion. It was all about Austin. There were no other ones out there. Jericho completed his slow burn heel turn through the fall here, but you had these turns left and right in the fall of 2001.
I love the Russo reset reference.
That's it, exactly. It is. You know, and it was sort of Russo-esque the way that it went here. You touched on briefly about the failed invasion, and I have read some stuff. I don't know if you've read this, and I wish I could remember where it was from, but as far as the part that the XFL might have played in this, because, yes, they were coming off their biggest year of business ever in 2000, but the XFL bled them dry as far as being such a big money loser. And Kevin Dunn, everybody's
money maker at the time. It actually took them from what should have been their best year into the red. Losing money.
That's right.
And what was their biggest money-making year on the wrestling side?
That's right. That's exactly right. And the IWC's favorite wrestling heel, aside from Vincent K. McMahon, Kevin Dunn, two things that I've read is that he is to blame in a lot of ways for how the invasion was booked. He's the one that got in Vince's ear and said, your guys have to be booked strong, not the guys coming in. There will be a failure of confidence because of the way the XFL thing went. I don't know what one has to do with the other. But that he got in Vince's ear about fans are already predisposed to have a failure of confidence in the product because of the XFL. Your guys have to be booked strong. And also, too, the notion of booking WCW as the traditionalists coming in versus sports entertainment. His thing was, well, nobody wants to see sports entertainment anymore. And to an extent, he's kind of right. WCW had been full-on sports entertainment since 99 anyways, so them reverting back to, we're, by God, the traditionalists of Gotch and Hackenschmidt would have been kind of, it wouldn't have fit.
Yeah, I'd read that about Dunn.
Yeah.
How he had gotten Vince's ear and he was kind of, you know, it's so stupid.
Right. Why should he be allowed to talk about wrestling anyway?
No. That's not stupid. What's stupid is the mentality of, oh, those are not our guys. We can't put them over strong.
Right.
It's like, they're your guys.
Right.
You're paying them.
Right.
It doesn't matter. You're making all the money. It doesn't matter.
Right.
They're all your stars. And look, we could do a whole entire podcast about why that angle failed.
Right.
The invasion.
We're not going to get into that.
We can't because this is about the 2002 Rumble. I'll just say this, though. I mean, it speaks volumes that the night after, like you just talked about, they just try to make you forget about the whole thing.
Yep.
And
It was pathetic.
Yeah, it really was.
It was like the Men in Black kind of like, you know, mind eraser deal.
No, what I was going to say is that it was like their first real, well, I shouldn't say it was the first, because we had talked about some booking issues in the last, when we talked about the 2000-2001 Rumble.
Fall of 2000.
But it was such a gag job. Like, they had, like, the angle of the century presented to them, and they just blew it.
Yep.
And, you know, doubling down on the Austin heel turn was dumb.
Calling it the Alliance.
The Alliance. What people wanted, and this is with the benefit of hindsight.
Right.
All people wanted, by people I mean the fans, was dream matches.
That's right.
That's all they wanted. They wanted guys, longtime WWF guys against longtime WCW guys. They wanted matches they'd never seen before. And that's not a new concept to wrestling.
Right.
People love new matchups. It's
right.
Why they kind of struggle now in the present day, because they don't have a lot of new matchups.
Exactly.
But if the only thing that Vince buying WCW ever gave us that was good were some of these dream matchups, and they were never presented as part of that angle.
It was
ironically
afterwards.
Enough, we get the first of those matches at this show, the 2002 Rumble.
We do.
2 months after the invasion angle ends.
We
so,
do.
You know, the stink of that, I think, permeated onto this show, but...
Sure. I mean, the product had fallen from grace in my estimation. It was a weird point in time because it didn't fall on its ass as much as it did later on.
No.
But to me, the bloom was off the rose, and it was just not what it was anymore by the 02 Rumble, although it was a great show in isolation.
Yes. If you just watch this show, you're like, this is really good.
Right.
They had a really star-studded roster still,
right.
A deep roster, which saved them. I mean, that was the thing. This was an era that they could get over the bad booking because they had a lot of good matches and they had a lot of talented performers.
Right.
But you just can't help but say, man, they should have been so much better this point. So
They really, really, really should have. And the thing is, too, there's two things I'm going to say in their defense that they couldn't really deal with, although they could have dealt with one of them better. The other one they couldn't have done anything about. The steal of the Alliance, remember, it was WCW and ECW together. They find out very shortly thereafter, with ECW in bankruptcy, they no longer have the rights to use the name on TV because it's in legal limbo. Just make it the WCW they absorb the Extreme Team. You know what I mean? Go back to calling it WCW versus WWF. That would have helped that one somewhat. But that was the Alliance thing was just stupid, calling it that, because it was so generic. The other one is...
It lasted 5 months.
It did.
That's incredible to me. Actually, 5 months is being pretty generous, because Booker T showed up at the King of the Ring, which is the June pay-per-view.
Right.
And then it ended at Survivor Series.
Well, and there's another thing, too, in terms of what cast a shadow over the Rumble show in 02 that had nothing to do with the product, that was something that... really kind of threw the invasion off of its axis. And it's something that they were not to blame for, although their capitalization of it 2 days later was dumb, was 9/11. It was hard to present focused shows that the people could wrap their minds around in that climate. That climate at that time, it was just a weird... I don't think anybody was completely thinking rationally the first couple of months. And reaching the wrestling fans in the same way... I don't give them a full pass for this.
I think that's kind of, I'll be honest with you, I mean, that's kind of weak.
No.
I mean, it's a big thing, but, like, there's no reason that they had to do, it's like they tried harder.
I'm not
because
giving
of
them a,
it.
Yeah,
like,
I'm not
they
giving
almost,
them a pass.
They almost, that whole period, pump the brakes.
Right.
Is what I would have told them. Like, we talked about in 2000 with the Austin heel turn.
Right.
They needed to realize, because they were like, oh, we got to do something big. Austin stales, he thinks he's stale as a face. When the WCW thing presented itself,
right.
When Vince bought it, they needed to think to themselves, okay, wait a minute. Why are we going to turn Steve Austin heel when we have what's going to be, what should be, the biggest angle of all time right at our fingertips?
Well,
people didn't want to see a heel Steve Austin leading a watered-down WCW. People wanted to see Steve Austin... as a babyface
fighting the
against
invaders.
The top guys from WCW that he never faced. They wanted to see Austin Hogan. Never got it. They wanted to see Austin Goldberg. Never got it.
Right.
And, you know, they blew it in the sense that they did not. And, again, this is what really hurt them.
Okay.
Is they were too cocky to acquiesce. And a lot of those guys were making a lot of money.
Right.
In the dying days of WCW, which was contributed to the death. But they needed to bring a big name in before they did it. Should have been Goldberg.
Should have been Goldberg.
They brought Flair in, obviously, the night after the angle ends, which is weird. And then they bring in Hogan a month after the Rumble.
Right.
But, well, along with the NWO.
The NWO team, yeah.
But it was just, they needed to think that thing through more. And I think in their minds, they're like, okay, well, we've got this big thing where Austin's going to be a heel. How can we make WCW fit that rather than it should have been, forget about that. Just do WWF versus WCW.
Well, and here's the thing.
Anything would have been better what they
and,
did.
And yes,
than what
it's
they
true.
Did.
Yes, it's true that the WCW guys that came in were, and this is largely a contractual issue of letting Time Warner pay off the bigger ones in the buyout, the only real names of significance in terms of guys who'd been booked as main eventers in WCW, I think, were Paige and Booker T. I think that was it. Having said that,
and to
though,
treat them the way they did was so foul.
They diminished
because those
them.
Were guys that actually took less money to come in. They're like, we're going to play ball.
Right.
And we'll work with you. And then they treat them like shit.
I got something I want to run past you before we move on. This is like my last point out of all of this, is that, and one of the things, you know, Kevin Dunn made as a point of, you know, booking the WWF guys so strong was, well, who are these guys? What does our public even know of them since you didn't bring in the big names, whatever? And he's right to an extent, but here's the thing, though, and this is where vengeance booking comes in. You got Jindrak and O'Hare as the tag team champions. I'm sitting there at the time going, what the hell is that for? Because the last Nitro in Panama City was supposed to be about aligning it a certain way, right? They get the title off of Steiner because he wasn't going to come in right away. They put it on Booker T. Who's the tag team that had the most heat the last couple of months in WCW? Totally Buff. It's a stupid name, whatever, but Bagwell and Luger coming in? Luger coming in going,
well,
I'm
they
coming
tried
back
to
this shiznit hole. I'm coming. How much heat could Luger have gotten coming back in there bad-mouthing WWF going, I jumped the Nitro the first night because this place sucks. There's things they could have done, but because Vince McMahon hates Lex Luger, it was never going
to
happen.
Yeah, same with Jeff Jarrett. Didn't like Jeff him Jarrett. Either. Bagwell they tried to bring in, and that didn't go so well in
no,
case
it
you
didn't.
Forgot.
It
so.
Didn't. But this is to kind of set the stage here because, again, this is – I don't know that there have been too many more interesting hinge times in company history than between 01 and 02. We're probably not going to do anything like this again with any of the subsequent Royal Rumbles because how much, like, earth-shaking stuff has happened in 1 year from this point to the next ever since the last couple in the modern era.
Spoiler alert, our next part five, is going to be entitled Split Happens.
Yeah.
And I had trouble finding a line of demarcation as to when to end that show. It's going to wind up being 03 to 07, but realistically, it could have gone on much longer. And, I mean, while a lot of the names did change by the time you got from 03 to, you know, 2008, 9, 10, on a year-to-year basis, not a lot changed.
No.
So, you're right. I mean, a lot, you did feel that the landscape had changed fairly dramatically, although, again, you put on this 2002 Rumble now. If you put it on and we watch it before we do this podcast,
yep.
You wouldn't. There was no mention of the invasion angle. There was
Steffi interacted with Austin 2 months earlier. They had been together leading the alliance, and there was no mention of it on screen. It was just typical heel versus face stuff.
That was the problem.
Yeah,
like and that hurt Austin as a face in here. We'll talk because Austin's almost kind of an afterthought in this show.
Right.
That it's like, well, oh yeah, don't remember that horrible time when we turned him heel.
Right.
You know, don't remember when Kurt Angle was a babyface.
Right.
There was just a lot of that, and it's like, well, we watched it. Why are you telling us that it shouldn't have mattered?
And that's one of the things, too. I've always said one of the things that killed WCW the most, one of the predominant factors in my mind, was the constant, and it wasn't all Russo, but Russo was responsible for a couple of them, the hard resets.
Yes.
Of where nothing you saw before this week matters. You can't keep doing that to the fan base.
No.
This is probably the most dramatic instance of it in WWF/WWE history. Has there ever been a point in time where they've ever tried to be like, forget everything that happened before, that didn't happen? If you want to remember anything, go back to last spring when Austin was a face again. I don't think they've ever done that before or since.
By the way,
it was just like it's a bad dream. They did the Bobby Ewing coming out of the shower thing, really.
By the way,
yeah,
we should mention this is the last Royal Rumble where we will say WWF.
Yes.
They changed to WWE.
Get the F out in a couple months.
Yeah, get the F out indeed. All right, let's talk. So we're done with the invasion. So let's talk about this show.
Yep.
The undercard here, there's not a lot to talk about early. You have a Dudleys versus Taz and Spike Dudley tag team title match.
Yep.
Dudleys were heels here. Had Stacy. Good act. They lose. I don't remember. I'll be honest with you. I didn't remember a ton about Taz and Spike Dudley as a team.
Short-term deal.
So I didn't even bother looking it up. It's an okay match.
Mm-hmm.
Good opener. But, again, it didn't really mean much. And, again, it's funny with the resets you talk about. Now, the Dudleys had turned heel as part of the invasion and stayed heel.
Right.
So that was okay. But Taz, you know, he was a guy who had just kind of become a face out of nowhere in the wake of the invasion, because he was obviously part of the alliance.
It started with him putting the Kaja Hajime on Paul Heyman, I think, in that thing.
Oh, that's right.
At the end of the invasion.
You're right. They did kind of at least tease that. You're right. And remember, he was like Austin's whipping boy,
right?
Which did him no favors. I'll grant you that.
So he turns face simultaneous with Austin. That's a great blow off, guys.
Yeah. Good point. Edge Regal's your Intercontinental title match here. Again, not much. I'll say this. Edge, I thought, was still a little overrated at this point. He really got good later in 02. He was a guy who really actually benefited from the brand split, which we'll obviously talk about in great detail later in the episodes. But he really got good working with the rest of the so-called SmackDown 6 throughout 2002. Of course, he gets hurt and keeps him on the shelf for a while.
Historically, he's easily top five all time as far as guys who benefited from the brand split.
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah,
well, you know why?
He's a slam dunk. Top three, I'd say.
You know why? Because he spent a lot of his time on SmackDown.
Yeah.
And while that was always the secondary brand, he was given room to shine on there.
There's a lot to be said for being outside of Triple H's direct reach.
Yeah. But arguably, I would say Edge didn't really start coming into his own until the whole Lita thing, to be honest with you.
Right.
Like, you know, not necessarily the title win and the whatever that live sex. I'm talking about like an 05 when he got as a heel. The Intercontinental title was changing hands too much during this era too. Regal was a guy who, while talented, was never booked strong.
Exactly.
Yeah, but he was never booked strong in this era, so it was kind of like, oh, well, that did Edge no favor. So, there was a woman's match here, Trish against Jazz. Not terrible.
Here's the irony. Quick thought on that is that one of his big proteges is Cesaro. He was almost sort of the Cesaro of his day as far as not being used
beg to differ in the sense that Regal was clearly, I mean, he was over the hill in 02. I mean, it's not that he was bad, but he was on the downside of his career. Regal, you had already seen peak Steve Regal. Yeah, I mean, to be honest, his peak was like 94. I mean, 8 years before this.
Yeah, isn't 94 like the last time he was really used well, though? I mean, that's how much of it is use and how much of it is...
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, he was effective in that heel commissioner role.
Yeah.
But, again, he was like a commissioner, and then he was, now he's a wrestler. Now we're supposed to take him serious as a wrestler if he was kind of a Weasley commissioner who had, like, kissed McMahon's ass and stuff. Remember, he was the original kiss my ass
that
club
did him
guy.
No favors.
Yeah.
But you were starting to talk about the next match, and it's funny because you and I had watched it here before we started going with it, and I was surprised in retrospect looking at it, like, how good it was. I'm conditioned to believe that,
this is Trish and Jazz for the women's title. Jackie as the ref for reasons I can't be bothered to remember.
Right. I mean, and you know, Trish and Jazz both showed more athleticism than I remembered from them, to be totally honest with you.
It's funny. I mean, you raise a good point. I mean, Trish was, I think it was because where the low bar she came from.
She gets graded on the curve a lot. But here she lived up to it.
And most people want to do her, obviously.
Right.
So, I mean, any pretty girl like that is going to be kind of graded on a curve by a male audience.
Right.
But No, it was okay. But I there's just not a lot to say with those three matches, all title matches. Again,
that's right.
We start to see the devaluing of titles as we move on through the years.
Here's the other thing, too. I mean, and this, I'm going to harken back very quickly to the invasion. Something that was damaging was you talk about the meaninglessness of, because WCW comes in with their full harvest of titles. I mean, that you basically doubled the titles overnight in the company.
Yeah, there was the U.S. title. And, like, they also, it was just roulette. I remember, it was funny, I joked with you. During 2001, it got to a point where I was actually rooting for the champion in every match because I wanted to stop seeing title changes. There were so many. If you go back and look at title history pages for 01, it was insane. And then what's funny is this is how the lunacy that was going on and how they had no long-term vision.
Mm-hmm.
So they consolidated the titles.
Mm-hmm.
But then they wind up having to expand them again in 03 when they do the brand split.
That's right.
So it was, you could clearly tell that there was no long-term vision in this company, or they always had to keep, or they kept screwing it up and they kept just throwing everything out the window. Compared to the previous years that we've talked about where you might not have agreed with everything, but in 98, 99, 2000, 01, they knew what they were doing.
This may be a controversial point. I'll say, because maybe people could think of other things, I'll say 2001 is the absolute nadir in company history as far as making titles outside the main event picture mean anything. Because here's one of the things, too.
They were all worthless.
Like, this is a very underrated point, too. You would have many instances of, quote-unquote, WCW guys holding WWF titles and vice versa, and there was no heat on that. There was no heat on this guy holds the other company's
title. You're absolutely
right.
Yeah, because did they do something where... Yeah, because remember, like, they had... It got to the point where Rock and Jericho, who we'll talk about because they have a very good match on this show...
were feuding over the WCW title.
Yeah, and that was dumb.
And here's the thing, too, and I can't remember this for sure, but I think when they did the unification match with the tag titles, Taker and Kane versus, who was it, DDP and...
And Canyon. That did not
Wasn't
go
it
well.
Like they were holding the opposite titles and nobody even cared?
Yes,
yeah,
it was.
Nobody even cared.
Yeah. I mean,
stupidity.
It was just belt roulette, man.
Your point about the first three matches here, to bring it back to what we were saying, is...
No one cared. The fact that they were title matches meant nothing.
Meant nothing, yeah. Because we were coming off of the greatest devaluation. I mean, this is like the devaluation of the peso, so to speak. Because, like, coming off of 01, those things meant nothing.
Okay.
So the show, for all intents and purposes, did not even really begin until... The fourth match on the card, and of course the last three were all real humdingers, no question.
Yes, humdingers. Huh?
Yes.
Well, okay. Vince McMahon versus Ric Flair. Again, we kind of alluded to this earlier. How ironic that the invasion angle is now over, but we get really the first quote unquote dream interpromotional match.
That's right.
I guess they did do Rock versus Booker T in 01, but
Booker T hadn't graduated to that level.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, it's funny, for as much as you and I and other people bitch about how WCW wasn't taken seriously, to WWF's point, Booker T kind of was not perceived by the fan base at large at The Rock's level, which is why you saw awful things like him having to do a handicap match with Shane the month after, which did him no favors.
You and I have talked about this previously. When we were doing some stuff on wrestling in the early 90s, the first time ever that this happened with a major company, and it happened with both of them in the span of about 60 days, Ron Simmons wins the WCW title out of nowhere, Bret Hart the WWF title out of nowhere. You cannot be, even an upper mid-card guy, get the belt out of nowhere and get that kind of credibility for your title reign. Bret Hart would admit to this day that that killed him in his reign here. Booker T is the same way. He gets hot-shotted to that spot. Now, they should have been building him for longer than they
initially
were.
Initially in 2000 that happened.
In 2000.
I thought he won his first title at that show Russo shot all over Hogan, right? It was like Bash of the Beach 2000.
Yeah, so he gets it as almost an afterthought to the Hogan angle there.
And the fact that he... does wind up winning it back during the awful era of WCW.
Right.
Again, that it makes it hard to take it seriously because no one cared about WCW at that point.
Right. So that's how I kind of look at it, too, is that, again, that's where I would say Rock, Booker T still doesn't rise to that level. Taker, DDP, now that's one that should have meant something, but the burial booking of DDP, the stalker crap?
Yeah.
Give me a break. It didn't work for my boy Barry Windham. It didn't work for DDP.
You know, I mean, Undertaker could get mad, and I guess he probably won't get mad because it's his ex-wife now, but why would, you know, somebody brought this up. Why would DDP stalk Undertaker's wife? His wife was hotter.
True. Mm-hmm. Also, to the thing that this is, while we're saying things that Undertaker's not going to like, I'll put one out there. I'm going to
call him out later when we talk about the Rumble.
Well, under the circumstances, one of the most painful things of divorce, even beyond the emotional stuff, is if you've tattooed the old lady's name on your neck and you got to go get it ripped off there. Notice he doesn't have Sarah on his pipes anymore.
No, he doesn't.
No, that must have been painful. Ugh.
Yeah, oof. Well, seemed like a good idea at the time. Speaking like of
a lot of things with women do.
Yeah. Speaking of seemed like a good idea at the time, Vince and Ric Flair. And this was good. Build was really good. There was a lot of great promos leading up to this. So if you forget, and it's easy to, Flair debuted the night after Survivor Series 01.
As part of the reset.
Yes. So the alliance is over, and Vince is doing this thing where I think he's going to award Kurt Angle the title.
He's the sole owner.
Yeah, and Flair comes out and reveals that he bought some sort of consortium.
The consortium was me. Woo!
Yeah. I think like that was just confusing for fans.
It was.
Like, no one really bought Flair as this co-owner of WWF.
Yeah.
It was kind of weird, but I think if you just said, again, like, they made things more complicated than they needed to be. Because if Flair had just come in, and again, I don't know how, I guess they needed a storyline excuse how he comes in.
Linda makes him commissioner that Vince can't get rid of. They did it all these other times, like with Mick Foley and whatever. Just do that.
I mean, yeah. People are just going to be happy to see Ric Flair, as is proof. But I lost my point again, damn it. But this was just good, is my only point.
You said the build-up was good.
No, there were promos. It was funny. There was even that one promo where Flair referenced McMahon bitching him out after WrestleMania 8, which really did happen for blading.
Yes.
Because, you know, Flair, it's funny with that show, Brett blades, and blading was a big no-no in 1992. And Flair saw that, and he's like, oh, I'll blade too.
Yeah.
And Brett lied. He's like, nope, that was hard way.
Yep.
And he got away with it. Flair's like, yeah, I blade. And Flair, like, bladed, like, right on screen pretty blatantly. And
look, Vince, no hands.
Yeah. And Vince is like, oh, I think the line they used in the one promo was, every time you do something great, you screw it up, Rick.
Right. And they found a storyline way to work it in.
And that was good. And although I thought the Vince McMahon character was getting cheesy at this point in 02, he was, like, sort of believing himself no longer.
Yep.
It was a big difference. We referenced this in previous mini episodes where when the Mr. McMahon character started out, he was still kind of like cowardly when it came to physical altercations with the wrestlers. Like, he'd always do the gulp,
right?
You know, the famous, you know, cartoonish gulp.
Vince Russo has put that down and thinks it's cartoonish. I think it's awesome. Vince is one of the top five facial guys of all time. Give the devil his due, and that's a part of it.
Yeah. No, it was funny, but, like, here he comes out. He's totally jacked, by the way. Hell of a workout plan. I'll have to get a hold of it.
Muscle and fitness.
Yes. And he gets a lot of offense in on Flair. Normally I'd bitch more about that, but it worked here in the sense that Flair, he was older. Obviously. Mm-hmm. And remember, like, Flair, I think in his book, talks about how going into this match, he didn't have a lot of confidence because he had been just booked so into the ground by Bischoff and WCW that this was a big confidence match for him. He goes over clean with the figure four. It's a street fight. Both guys blade, ironically enough. And I really enjoyed this. And again, I think what came to me watching this, and I said to you off air, and I already said it 2 minutes ago, and I'll say it again, is the irony that we're getting this dream match, because Jerry even references, oh, you know, a few months ago, who would have ever thought we would even see this match?
That's right.
And that was what the invasion was supposed to be, and we get it after that angle ends.
And this
was another thing, though. The follow-up, like, was just,
because they were leading into the brand split, and that these two were going to have to go their separate
ways. And this was my issue with Flair being the owner. There was nowhere to go after this, because Vince wasn't going to leave.
Right.
Unless if Vince was going to leave, then it would be one thing. But, like, they still had to interact after Flair beats his ass in this match. And it didn't work. And Flair, a few months after this, winds up being, like, a heel. He gets run out of, you know, control of the company, which, it made no sense.
Right.
And then, you know, he's a heel, which no one really wanted. You know, we've talked about this. No one. There became a point in time. I don't know when this point in time was. I guess it was probably when the NWO came about in WCW, that no one wanted to really boo Ric Flair anymore.
It demoralizes the fan base. It's one of the most underrated things because people don't talk about it. But again, factors in killing WCW, the insistence on shoving Flair as a heel down our throats is one of them. Nobody wants to boo Ric Flair.
And he
The
thing is, he wanted to be a heel in like early 99.
Yeah.
Remember they did the double turn, him and Hogan?
Completely nonsensical. Worst double turn of all time.
That was when that company really started hitting
the
skids.
The bottom fell out. I have in my notes here that we talked about this previously. Again, things that you would never see today. Flair apparently being referred to at one point as concussed by JR during the match. Making light of head injuries and stuff. But the way that it went here, again, this match with Vince McMahon, this is an outlier in terms of Vince McMahon v. big-time superstar matches. Can you guess how? I think you and I have talked about this previously, but anytime Vince goes up against a big superstar, this happens, but it didn't happen here with Flair.
What happened?
Largely because, again, this match was third from the top, so it wasn't responsible for a buy rate, but Vince McMahon singles matches have always drawn surprisingly poorly. This one didn't because it wasn't...
I don't think this was a draw. Although, it's funny, I told you, for me personally, this was the match I was looking forward to. I remember old 21-year-old Kyle.
Yeah.
This was the match I was looking forward to the most going into the show.
But, I mean, like, you compare it to versus Triple H, versus Hogan, versus Shawn Michaels. Those ones all fell on their ass in terms of business.
Yeah,
this one didn't, but it was third from the top, though.
Yeah, the WrestleManias where Vince was, you know, was billed in one of the top matches. The two that come to mind are 19 against Hogan and 26 against Bret.
Right.
Where he was like, that was a prominently billed match.
Right.
Those have both done poorly. I mean, the match against Steve Austin, which was the main event at St. Valentine's Day Massacre, the big culmination.
Biggest of them all. Yeah.
That was, you know, you talk about that Hogan Flair double turn.
Yeah.
That match beat the St. Valentine's Day Massacre on pay-per-view.
That pay-per-view. Shocking.
WCW was beating WWF still in buy rates in early 99, just for those keeping score
truly,
at home.
Truly shocking, because they were getting massacred in every other realm here. But, a very good...
They weren't really. They weren't the TV...
In ratings.
Not yet. It wasn't until later in 99 that it just became a huge chasm.
Well, I think the double turn in March is where the ratings started.
It was May of 99 when Hogan left, and they, like, just inexplicably started pushing Kevin Nash as a babyface. If you look at it, May of 99 is when WCW really fell off a cliff, and then they fell off an even bigger cliff in January of 2000.
That's right.
So as badly booked as that company was in 1998, they were still doing shockingly good business.
That's right.
So that just for the record. Jericho versus Rock is your world title match on the show.
Mm-hmm.
Like every Jericho Rock match, this is good. They had great chemistry.
They did.
With one another.
They did.
I don't think this match is quite as good as the match they had a few months earlier for the WCW title. We talked about it, which was kind of goofy. But you remember that was billed as, can Chris Jericho win the big one? And he finally did after 2 years of being in the company and not beating any of the established WWF guys.
Right.
He finally gets the win over The Rock. Stephanie, some curious interference that led nowhere. That kind of bothered me.
Kind of weird. Here's the thing, too, is that, you know, and I've referred to some things as being, you know, the nadir of company history the previous year. I'm not going to cite this element from this match as the greatest of all time, but it is almost sort of like the platonic ideal in terms of, you hear this criticism that comedy doesn't sell. Jericho and The Rock had just enough comedy in this match to really make it entertaining. That's an underrated part of it.
Are you okay there, buddy?
Yeah, choking a little bit.
Are you okay? Well, I mean, the match was good, but, I mean, Jesus, there's no need to take a swig, buddy.
All right, better now somewhat, but, yeah, that's. Do you agree with my point? They did comedy the right way?
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of comedy, to be honest with you. I don't really want to talk. I just want to laugh at you as you have no voice.
This wasn't
on my format sheet, Tony.
We'll see.
I tried to get you to do a spit take, and it didn't work. Damn it.
The restorative powers of almond milk.
Yeah, by comedy, it was subtle comedy. It was stuff like Jericho brought back the arrogant
the right
pin.
Way.
It wasn't like WWE toilet comedy.
Well, like, no, but like when he was going to do the people's elbow, that kind of.
Yeah, he did the people's elbow, and there was a great, before the match even started, there was a great interaction where, you know, The Rock always did his little just bring it thing.
That's right.
And he was about ready to start talking trash back to Jericho. Jericho puts his hand in Rock's face, and then he does the just bring it to Rock. So, yeah, there was some good stuff here. And I gave this 4.25, but my only issue with it was, just, again, it's not as good as the match of the year contenders that were brought to us in the previous two Rumbles, the Triple H Foley
That's
in 2000 or Benoit Jericho in 2001. But
it was a hell of a standard being set if you think about it.
Yeah, but and this is a few steps below, so half star less at 4.25 than those other two. My only issue with it, and I think maybe this is what's responsible for being a little lower, is that it was sort of indicative of Jericho's whole failed title run here.
Right.
He was not booked as a strong champion. We talked about that with Angle the year previous. And again, I'm not saying Jericho or Angle would have gotten any more over than Triple H if they got the same booking favors. But those booking favors did exist for one of the three, and it can't be ignored.
Right.
Compare how Jericho wins this match on a roll-up after interference, and how Angle wins his match the year previous at Triple H with Steve Austin coming in and just stunning Triple H, basically making Angle kind of look like a geek, to how Triple H beat Mick Foley in 2000.
Right.
Where in a bloodbath, he pedigrees him in thumbtacks and pins him clean. Gee, who got over more as a heel champ there?
Well, that was supposed
big
to be the
surprise.
Big franchise star-making performance. That there was,
and it was, and it was fine. And I guess in their minds, they weren't doing that with Angle and Jericho. So why even do that? I guess
right.
That's what they would say.
That's what they would say.
But it's really funny. I'm going to talk about, you know, we'll talk about Jericho Triple H, how that didn't work this time around after we talk about the Rumble.
Well,
I
told you I had a criticism about the booking of The Rock that I thought you might find surprising here.
Okay.
And this is a subtle thing, but I've used the term before, probably mostly off air. Vince's attempt to white meatify every babyface, that he takes what got them over as a heel and disregards it. And you would see it with Triple H. You would see it in the spring here. It would only get worse. Lucy the dog and all that crap. You know, he's not Triple H, the badass heel that got cheered eventually. With The Rock, it's this. I noticed he was wearing that T-shirt that he had in there. And By the way, that's another thing, too. The Rock had gotten away from the $500 shirts, which that's one of the things that got him over as a heel. It was being the flashy, ostentatious Rock. So now Rock's just like everybody else with the merch. That's okay if it's cool merch. This was post 9/11 Rock. And he's got this shirt, and it's...
I didn't think we'd be talking 9/11 in this podcast.
Yeah,
twice.
Well, look at where we were on the historical calendar. It had that quote on the back that started with something like, "We who are truly brave will..." Yeah, I think it was like, "We'll never cower." And it's like, you know what it should have been? It should have been, you know, "Hey, Bin Laden, take it and stick it straight up your candy ass." Like, Rock needed to be cool, badass Rock at all times. Versus Vince was jumping on the patriotic bandwagon. You don't use The Rock for that. It may surprise you to hear a man of my politics decry the use of him in that way, but I'm talking as a wrestling fan and analyst. The Rock.
I think you're fishing for something that ain't there.
That's a white meat thing, buddy. That's a white meat thing. The Rock. Here's the thing.
I thought The Rock was still cool here.
The Rock has the vulnerability historically to get booed when he gets away from being the coolest guy in the room, which is what got him over in the first place.
And to your point, I guess to your point, 2 months later, he got booed against Hogan. Although that was always Toronto was always a strong Hogan market, and the nostalgia.
You know what? And Hogan.
I don't think that had
Austin
to do with
it. Would have gotten not the amount of boos, but Austin would have gotten a good chunk of The Rock's boos in that crowd. They just wanted to cheer Hogan and boo.
Yeah, they had decided that. You're
so
probably right.
I didn't expect you to agree with me on that point, but I think that's part of the white meat babification of Rock that was the slippery slope throughout the year. He got more and more unpopular, booed out of the building as a face against Brock, and is forced to come back as a heel the next year. I'm not telling you that one T-shirt here was the beginning of it, but I think it's symptomatic of Vince's issue. I just wanted to get that in there.
Interesting. So yeah. you like this match?
Four and a quarter?
What do you think about that rating?
Seems fair. I'm maybe a little closer to four, but yeah, it was pretty good.
Okay. Well, I didn't know there was something between four and four.
Well,
a quarter.
That's the next
what
one
is this
now.
Pitch? It was this pitchfork here. 4.1. We're giving it 4.2.
I was gonna say, you know, 4 1/8. But
okay,
you
okay,
know,
okay. There we
I'll
go.
Give you that.
So again, yeah, I just think that, you know, the only issue I have with this is Jericho. And they even alluded to as a weak champion in the build-up. They're like, "I am not a joke." You know, it's like, why would you have your champion who's kind of perceived weakly say that?
Yeah.
Even if it's true. I think that only strength, and he was drawing good heat here. There were the Jericho sucks chants.
Here's the thing, though. We were still, this was the tail end, though. But this was the tail end of the era of you know, too cute by half breaking the fourth wall. And we already, as smart fans, knew about the concept of a transitional champion.
And he was a transitional champion.
He was a
champion.
Transitional champion. But again, isn't that almost a Russo-type move to have him allude on camera to the notion of a
you're
transitional
right. Well, yeah,
champion?
If it was Russo, he'd be like, I am not a transitional champion, which
well,
would
exactly.
be like cringeworthy. But.
Exactly. So it's like we're supposed to think it's better than Russo just because he didn't use those words. But it's the same mentality.
And we'll get into this when we get into the fallout of this entire show.
Sure.
We'll have to talk about the Rumble, obviously.
Right.
But the Triple H Jericho dynamic would have worked better had Jericho been booked stronger. If they hadn't made it
Absolutely.
So blatantly obvious that he was a transitional champion,
right.
then it would have been fine.
Right.
But the fact that it was so obvious, like, I think really hurt that. And it
total sacrificial.
It hurt Jericho more moving forward than it did here. I thought here was fine. I mean, because The Rock is The Rock.
Although,
like I said,
the
these
thing,
two are
though,
always good against each other.
In terms of transitional champions, I'll give you this. I like the idea of delaying it, putting it on somebody until about, like, December. Royal Rumble is probably too late, but it's like, I hate the ones that start at Survivor Series or in October or whatever, because then it's just like, oh, okay, great, another pointless battle, you know, pay-per-view on the road to WrestleMania. Jericho's title length was at least perfect for what he was setting out to do.
I could make an argument that they maybe, given how he was booked,
mm-hmm.
should have just ended it in February like they did with Angle the year previous, and they could have gone with Austin. We'll get to that
okay.
in a minute because I had an idea
okay.
I was kind of sharing with you before
okay.
we started taping here that if that Austin Triple H certainly, at both his faces,
mm-hmm.
would have been a stronger main event than Jericho Triple H was, and we wouldn't have had needed Lucy the Dog and, you know, Triple H and Stephanie renewing their vows and stuff like that. We wouldn't have had any of that, needed
right.
any of that. And I have an idea how they could have had that work for all parties involved.
By the way.
It was just, to me, that's the one difference between Jericho's run here and Angle's the previous year, is they actually let Jericho go to WrestleMania with his run while
right.
Angle, you know, lost it at the February pay-per-view.
I think subtleties play a huge part in terms of conditioning the audience. I probably believe that more than a lot of people. I told you off air, the pigtail that he had, he lost his gravitas with that. He looked like he was 14 years old. I understand you want to get him away from glamorous-looking babyface Chris Jericho, but you know what? I would err on the side of that. He could still get booed through his mannerisms, through his mic work, whatever. It's not necessary. He looked like a geek with the pigtail. That was stupid.
Yeah, that's more
I don't think
you.
I,
that's
I don't
more
think,
you.
I'm not nitpicking.
That's more you. I didn't notice the ponytail.
Yeah, well,
I noticed how he was booked weekly. That's what I noticed.
Let me channel some 98 Jericho. Don't you call me a nitpicker.
Yes, there we go. So this is a History of the Royal Rumble
yep.
anthology, right?
Well,
we should probably talk about the Rumble, unless if, I'm sorry, did I jump the gun here?
Oh, no, I'm setting it up for the Rumble match here. I have in my notes, in between the title match and the Rumble itself, I have in my notes, this is the first year that we saw a version. This is not a great moment in wrestling history, but it's the first year they ran one of those asinine do-not-try-this-at-home videos. For all you morons out there, don't try this at home. First year they did it at the Rumble.
I think there was some issue. There's some case out there in the legal system that I think going out the time. I don't know.
This was the first version of the corporate video that they had.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah. So we should talk about the Rumble match itself.
JR.
Maybe we're not going to.
JR interviewed HBK from WWF New York. Remember that, kids?
Yes. You know, that kind of. I know it failed, but that kind of made the. I thought that kind of made the shows look okay, like you
it
know,
because
like you know, like because whatever they do, like Fox is always guilty of this. Like during the baseball playoffs, they always show like the fans watching
right.
at the local bar. And I thought that WWF New York gave WWF that feel. I thought it was okay.
Sure,
I mean, it failed. It didn't work.
Right,
but and
well,
it was a big money loser. But it seemed like they would always cut to whenever the show came on the air, you know,
mm-hmm.
they'd show obviously the live crowd, then they'd cut to WWF New York, and it would seem like it would make it seem like what you were watching was, you know, a slightly bigger deal. I mean, those interviews they always did were always kind of worthless. I think HBK didn't even know anything at this time.
Yeah.